Everybody's here?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm starting about 5 minutes late, so without further... this is the first of two lectures on two-weight inequalities. This is sort of going to be the sort of a broader overview, so to speak. So what is the question is that you take an operator of some type, for example, so let me list three things that one could hold in one's head: the maximal function, fractional integral, and the last and most difficult question, operator would be a Hilbert transform. By fractional integral, I mean in one dimension, t of f of x is integral f of x minus y dy over dividing by y to some power. And in the Hilbert transform, this being is a positive operator, and the Hilbert transform hf of x would be principal value integral f of x minus y dy over y, a non-positive operator. And then the question is to characterize pairs of weights omega and sigma. By weight, I mean locally finite Borel measure, non-negative Borel measure. For which, and here again, I'm going to state the inequality in sort of its simplest form, T of sigma f. So if I take a local, if this is Borel measure, then sigma f is Borel measure, and I can plug it in to these formulas. And it makes sense. And take LP and omega, and then this should be less than some constant, function of omega and sigma, f LP of sigma. So this is not necessarily the first form one would consider. You might consider where you had a sigma here, for instance. You just covered this up, but it turns out so that you would have one weight here and another weight there. It turns out this is the more natural formulation. This formulation is the one in which the characterizations that we know is expressed. And moreover, this inequality dualizes in the appropriate way. So namely, T star, the formal dual to this inequality is T star of omega phi LP sigma is less than C omega sigma phi LP omega. The weights, the behavior of the weights is not, need not be governed by the structure of T. So the, for instance, so much has been made of the extension of different operators to the setting of homogeneous space, which locally acts like a Euclidean space, can be patched together, and these local approximations can be patched together in a coherent fashion. And this problem, and the two-weight problem, omega and sigma have no, can be concentrated on Cantor sets, and there's no relevant notion of homogeneous space that you can appeal to. So it's sort of they're hard because they're, the structure of the measure spaces is completely decoupled from the structure of the operator. Nevertheless, it is the, this it is a basic question. So for the, there are different questions, name and so in spectral theory. T equals over transform or Cauchy transform arise in a fundamental way. So the operator, and this is also an important point, the operator is distinguished. It is the Hilbert transform. And then one has classes of measures, of specific pairs of measures for which you'd like such an equality for the Hilbert transform itself. Not the class of Cauldron-Zygmund, not fractional integral for the Hilbert transform. So it, so the question is highly dependent upon the choice of T. If the work of Tulsa on analytic capacity is the Cauchy operator, the Cauchy transform is the Cauchy integral is the relevant operator, and there is one additional feature. That the measures you so in this language omega of a ball in the complex plane of radius r would be less than or equal to r, though one doesn't have a lower bound. The measure omega would be concentrated on a rectifiable curve, for instance, delivering. Would be uniform measure on a rectifiable curve delivering such estimate, though you will not have the lower bound. So this is not the L4's regular case. And in this case, there's a curious feature that you have a little additional information about the measure, which nicely links up with the structure of the transform, and that turns out to be a decisive feature. So there's questions in spectral theory, there's questions in analytic capacity, and ongoing questions in geometric measure theory, which are closely related to the two-weight problem. In the subject of analytic function space, there's also a range of related questions, and I'd very much like the answer for such question for the Cauchy transform. So, it's and it's very hard. It might help. It's for an overview. It sort of helps to keep in mind that some sort of chart, you know, from T, you can go to discrete. Operators, and there's actually a quite satisfactory theory here, and it splits into there's a strong splitting between the positive case and the non-positive, if you go over and then you have continuous case, and all the examples I've listed up there all fall in this category. And again, you would have the positive case, and there is a very strong relationship between dyadic, or discrete rather, and the continuous positive case. Then you have the non-positive. And the connection is far less strong. Now, in the positive, so let me state the theorem, Eric Sawyer's maximal function theorem. So if I define, so the maximal function, so that f of x is sup t 1 over 2t minus t to t f of x minus y dy. If you're familiar with the AP theory, you would know that the maximal function is bounded on LP of single weight if the weight is AP, which is a nice simple condition, which I guess I'm not certain I'll recall it, but and the interesting thing about this result is that the characterization is more subtle than that. So M of sigma F LP of omega is less than F LP of sigma if and only if you take the maximal function, you apply it to the indicator of, well, I'm in one dimension of some interval. So that is, you take f and you replace it by the simplest natural object. And then you have to test this, LP of omega, and it should be less than a uniform constant, so C sigma I for all intervals. So it might, I had mentioned AP, so let me state the much easier. Is it okay? Oh, yes, you're right. So this came as a surprise in 1981. It might, at the same paper, he proved the following much easier statement, M of F stigma. And here, well, I should write it this way. I will write down the weak LP statement. Omega of S bigger than lambda to the 1 over P. So this is the weak LP norm, is less than F LP of sigma, if and only F. Sup on I, omega of I over I, the 1 over P, sigma of I over I to the 1 over P prime is finite. And now this is a variant of the AP condition, and if I take sigma of, I should be a little careful. So the classical Muckenhalp-Wieden AP condition is written this way. Omega is an AP. It's fundamental to the classical AP theory that the weights be non-negative almost everywhere. Which point is in every standard book, but not necessarily stressed. And omega of I over I, omega to the 1 minus P. So if omega is non-zero almost everywhere, there's no question about this. And so this means that the density of this has this much local integrability. I'll write it out in integral form. Somehow this doesn't look right to me. This should be a P. Yeah, P prime. So omega is an AP, the classical Muckenhalp space. If first of all, the weight has density, and the density is non-negative almost everywhere. And moreover, the product of these two numbers over each interval is finite. And here you have the integrating omega, and its average value. It's easiest if you think take P to be 2 at first read. Then this is the average value of omega, and this is the average value of 1 over omega, not being the first power. And so this says not only does omega times omega inverse equal 1 pointwise, but on average at all scales, the same thing is true. That's the easiest case to keep in one's mind. And now this case, then it's the classical result that this is the condition that characterizes the one weight case in the case when the omega is non-negative almost everywhere. So the theorem is that M of F LP of omega is less than CF LP of omega, if and only if omega is an AP. So this fits. So this condition is analogous to this one, and in fact is exactly the same with the right definition of sigma. Right, I haven't written this one in the same form. Right. But there's a change of variables which I didn't think I was going to say anything about. But what you do is if you set sigma to be this guy, then this inequality is the same as omega of sigma f LP of omega is less than C F LP of sigma. So this is an elegant change of variables argument which allows you to convert such inequality to this formulation. And you can see that if you have this, if this formulation is actually much, if this is the ultimate goal, then this formulation is actually much more convenient. So it's an elementary change of variables argument that shows the equivalence of these two. So based on the wonderful conceptual, the wonderful successes in the AP theory and the truth of this result, it was conjectured that if one passed to two weights, that this, the naive extension of the AP condition, would be characterized the maximal function bound. But that's not the case. And the characterization is more intricate.
For positive omega or
almost everywhere. So you're allowed to come down to a point, for instance. Excuse me? Just for right. Just for L. The basic example of a borderline a two weight is omega of x is absolute x, because it just fails the inverse, which is required by the condition up there, just fails integrability. So the Sawyer maximal function theorem was the first two-weight theorem of this, and is basic to the subject. The next significant contribution also comes from Eric. It took some time to figure it out. And it's the analog of the fractional integral case. In fact, I think I'll go ahead and state a more general result. And this has to be this sets out the main themes of the subject, actually. So this is just definition of T of F will be the sum over I's that are dyadic intervals of I take a function and I compute its average value over the dyadic interval. So that's what I mean by this, the average value of f over interval I. And I have some sequence of some non-negative numbers, and then indicator of I. And the tau sub I's are non-negative. And so then the theorem, it's a two-weight is that T, you have the two-weight inequality, LP of omega is less than F LT of sigma, if and only if. And now we have the conclusions are basically the T of one theorem of David and Journay. So you take T and you start using so this condition is actually looking like Eric's maximal function LP of omega is less than sigma I 1 over P. But you also need the dual condition to this. So this is much like an Eric's theorem, but you need the dual condition as well. T star, and of course the operator is self-dual, but it's helpful to keep in mind that this is the dual condition. LP prime of sigma. Notice that the roles of omega and sigma are just reversed. 1 over P prime. So these conditions should hold uniformly over all intervals. So they're obviously necessary. This one follows simply by placing this in for F, and this one follows by dualizing this inequality and then taking the same step. So the proof of this, well, this is actually how this results. This is kind of an attractive result because omega and sigma are arbitrary Borel measures, but the T, the operator, is also kind of arbitrary, right? So omega, T, and sigma are all completely decoupled. So the for special tau I related to fractional integrals, this is Sawyer's theorem for in 1987. Notice if you're there's a curious detail here. If you think T is fractional integral, so which would make tau sub I to be the length of I to some root, then you wouldn't expect LP to LP. The fractional integrals take LP to LQ, but it is allowed in the two-weight case, and in fact that's the difficult case. And this is a this argument took some time to figure out. I'm not sure that I'll be able to characterize it exactly, but it combines at least a couple of significant new proof techniques. For P equals 2. Much later, circa 1990, this is the theorem of Nazarov trail in Volberg, using now I can, their proof is also quite subtle and sophisticated, but I can easily summarize it by saying it's a Bellman function proof. And then the form here is much more recent. It's myself, Eric Sawyer, and Ignacio. And it's a byproduct. It's really taking Eric's argument. And making sure that it works in this dyadic setting, and for all P's and Q's, for all LP. Whereas the Bellman function proof is really limited to P equals 2. Not to say it doesn't work in other cases, but certainly it's a significant calculation to verify that it does. So this is the theorem that, and especially the fractional integral version from 1987, that sets out the what one anticipates as the answer to many of these these two-weight questions. Unfortunately, at this point, the only real case that we have left, and that's completely solved, and I guess that T is this beautiful result of Nazarov trail and Volberg, again in the dyadic case. So T of F is, I'm going to write it in this form. So I take F, GI, and HI. So I write T as a sum over dyadic intervals of rank 1 projections. And the G sub I and H sub I are supported on dyadic interval I and constant on subintervals I prime containing I prime less than some fixed index tau. So start from I, pass down through the dyadic generations, tau levels, and the functions are constant. Then there's a very precise analogy of this theorem as well as the theorem of David and Jornet. So this is the theorem of Nazarov trail in Volberg, 2009. T of sigma F L2 of omega is less than F L2 of sigma if and only if three conditions, two are in precise analogy to these two, and the third is the first one is the only one that's any different, and it says that tau of sigma indicator I omega indicator J and absolute value less than sigma of I omega of j to the square root, provided I and j, you only have to test it for I and j is like this. Let me say 2 to the 2 tau I contains j, or reverse. So if I and j are relatively close in the dyadic grid, as measured by this number tau, then you have to test this condition, which is obviously weaker than that. And this is the analog of weakly bounded. And then the other two conditions are just as before, a t sigma indicator I L2 of omega is less than sigma of I to the 1/2. And now t star, notice that t star is now a completely distinct operator. You've interchanged the roles there. Omega indicator I L2 of sigma is less than omega of I to the 1/2. Okay, so this is a very pretty extension of Eric's fractional integral paper results, as well as the T of 1 theorem of David and Journay. It is the style of argument is also very attractive. It is in a certain sense, you take a particular proof of the T1 theorem of David and Journay and you simply lift it up to this setting. And it works. So the method of proof to lift a, and here I'm not going to try to explain his words, just write them, a martingale proof of David and Journay to one theorem. In particular, you use Haar functions that are adapted to the weights omega and sigma so that one can appeal to certain martingale identities. This is one of the Nazarov, Trail, and Volberg's innovations, and it's very attractive in this setting because, again, you don't know anything about omega and sigma. Well, between the this theorem and this theorem, the dyadic case looks largely done. Obviously just L2, it is, and the proof technique is strongly limited to L2, and the LP case, as it turns out, is much harder. But certainly it's very satisfying. So now the conjecture for the Hilbert transform. So the conjecture for Hilbert transform is that omega and sigma are we're gonna say that they don't share a point mass and then you would have omega h of f sigma It could be that such, that in the, for general, there may be problems with definition. The definition is taken in principal value sense. So the H, because of the singular values, there's there, and the fact that you don't have much control of omega and sigma, there is a problem with definition. We define H to be the limit of the truncations of the integrals, where we won't have any question about the existence. So then the conjecture, the outlines of the conjecture are reasonably clear. So H, sigma, indicator I, L2 of omega is less than C, F, L2 of sigma. And the reverse, the dual condition, that should be omega sigma of I, omega of I to the 1/2. But there's something, the continuous case turns out to be much harder. And it's partly reflected in that the weakly bounded condition doesn't seem to be strong enough, and so it has to be replaced by P, I mean Poisson integral. I write down a definition in just a second. The Poisson integral on over I of sigma times the Poisson integral over I of omega should also be finite. And so the Poisson of I and sigma means integral over the real line of length of I over if you like, take the Poisson extension of sigma to over the real line, and then evaluate the Poisson integral at the center of the interval at length I up from the real axis. So there's a key feature of the dyadic case that allows you to localize the operator in a very significant way, which is completely missing in the continuous case. So the Poisson integral winds up popping up in a number of different places, and we can't yet verify the conjecture. So let me, so the Nazarov trail Volberg had a beautiful theorem that says the conjecture is true subject to pivotal conditions. Pivotal condition is actually a rather attractive condition. It says the following, for all intervals I naught, for all strict subpartitions, I sub R, I'm now going to write down a kind of strengthening of the A2 condition that I've written down over there. Right? I didn't say this, but this is clearly an analog of the A2 condition. It says the Poisson of sigma times the Poisson of omega basically cancel. So now I sum R is 1 to infinity, so over my strict subpartition of I naught, and I take the Poisson of I sub r sigma squared, which is then I multiply by omega. So this is a kind of Poisson, a certain integral of the second moment of the Poisson, and this should be less than sigma of I naught. Now notice that 1 omega times this is basically giving you the Poisson of sigma without that I up there. So then if you could somehow replace, if somehow this were less than or equal to sigma of I sub r, then you could simply sum over the partition to recover this bound. And in nice situations, this is exactly what happens. But of course, such that this be dominated by that is certainly not true in the general case. Now this is, as I said, a very attractive, so the NTV theorem is that if this condition holds, and the dual condition holds, the dual interchanging omega and sigma, then the conjecture is true. It turns out that the pivotal condition is not necessary. And in the last, I'll close with a description of an example that we've uncovered. So the pivotal conditions are not necessary for the two weights. The story is a little more complicated. We've been through the Nazarov-Trail-Volberg argument, which is a fabulous and intricate construction. We can weaken the pivotal condition to what appears to be the weakest condition that the proof will allow, and we still can't prove the conjecture. And indeed, hiding behind the pivotal condition is the pivotal condition guarantees you certain decay and off-diagonal estimates that one does not expect to be true in full generality. So, nevertheless, with our conditions that are weaker than the pivotal condition, we can verify the following example. Okay. So, omega is uniform measure on 1/3 Cantor set. By which I mean that if you take the interval from 0 to 1/3 and 2/3 to 1, this is the first step of the approximation, and omega signs mass 1/2 here and 1/2 here. And in the second stage with four intervals, it assigns measure 1/4 to each. So let me draw the second stage. Now I have to tell you where sigma is, sigma will be points, Z11 at the top level will be a point in the interior. It will turn out that you can't choose the center. Second generation, second point, and so on. Now, so sigma will be sigma will be the sum over k is 1 to infinity of the sum j is 1 to 2 to the k minus 1 of a point mass at the z k j's. And this number, and now I need a weight, a dkj. The weight will only depend upon k, but let me put the redundant notation there for consistency. Now I should tell you there's two things that I should describe to you, how to choose these numbers and how to choose these points. So choose the dkj, you should satisfy A2 condition. So if I'm at the kth level and I pass to the and I'm at this point, let me pass to the two neighbors. I pass to the two neighbors. Now omega, and I need to let me call that omega assigns mass 2 to the negative k to each of the neighbors. Now the length of the interval at the kth stage, now the fractal nature comes into play, and I take 3 to the negative k. So this ratio is basically the omega measure of this guy at the kth stage divided by its length. The omega measure is here, the sigma measure is there, and now I take the 3 to the negative k. So I take the length in the A2 condition, and then I put the mass that sigma places in that interval, which it's more than dkj, but let's ignore the more part for the moment, and you get this. And this should be basically 1. In order for the A2 condition to hold, it's certainly required. And this tells you that dkj is basically 2 to the k over 9 to the k. So nice geometric series. So even though I've made a small error here, the error is easy to handle. So that specifies the dkj's and motivates my assertion that they satisfy the Poisson A2 condition. But if you choose these points to be the centers of the intervals, you will have difficulty verifying the two testing conditions. And in particular, when you apply H to omega, and you seek to test its L2 norm against sigma, these orange points, you will have problems unless you choose these points correctly. And so now you should consider what H of omega looks like on a component of the complement of the Cantor set. So these two intervals are coming from the kth generation of the Cantor set, and I'm considering H of omega, and you can convince yourself that it in this component H omega is in fact monotone decreasing function. It decreases from minus infinity from plus infinity on the left hand side and the rate of increase is really rather rapid, reflecting the fact that the Cantor set has fractal dimension. And also easy, explicit calculation that one can do. And in particular, there is unique zero. And that is where, why I use the letter Z, because that is where you place your point mass, and in so doing, when you seek to verify this inequality, the estimates on this function, on this norm, you gain a huge cancellation. And moreover, the details of the computation say that if you make a seemingly small perturbation of this point, namely perturb it by a small multiple of the length of this component, you can construct a measure sigma which does not satisfy the two-weight inequality. So this example not only shows, it's also easy to see that it doesn't satisfy the pivotal conditions, and it also illustrates how subtle this two-weight question is. At this point, I think I've gone a little over. Thank you for your attention.